Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details. Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome to the Analyst Inside Cricket with me, Simon Mann, and Simon Hughes. In this edition, we're going to be talking about the future of the game, the viability of Test cricket, the power of T20, and we're going to get the inside story of how to set up an Indian Premier League franchise and how to run it. Simon's new book covers that, A New Innings. It's just been published, and the book is partly a detailed analysis of the business of cricket and sport in general. It's partly a how-to manual for setting up a T20 team. It's co-authored with Manoj Badali, who in 2008 formed a consortium to buy the Rajasthan Royals franchise in the newly formed Indian Premier League. The Royals were huge underdogs, but under the captaincy of Shane Warne, they created a major upset by winning that first tournament. They're about to begin their 12th season in the competition in the UAE, with many England stars in their squad. They've not won it since 2008, that first tournament. The book also examines how cricket and sport will have to adapt following the potentially devastating impact of COVID-19. I started by asking Manoj who the book is aimed at.
Well, it's actually been a somewhat of a joke within the families, because it's been such a multi-year project. And actually, originally, the book started out as a way of just chronicling the extraordinary roller coaster that was the IPL and the Rajasthan Royals in the first few years. I think the first edition was actually called you couldn't script it. And then when we got terminated and then suspended, it felt like there was a lot that we were learning about the business of India. I think we called that version fast and at times unplayable. And then when Simon and I got together a couple of years ago to sort of review the material that I'd amassed over the years, we felt that actually the thing that was really missing was a book that unpacked the business of cricket and to some extent the business of sport, because the IPL has been such an extraordinary business success in so many ways.
How difficult was it to write, to sort of get everything down? You know, 12 years ups and downs. You mentioned the downs, and there have been downs as well. You were suspended from the IPL, but of course you won the first IPL.
Yeah, no, look, actually a few people that read sort of early manuscripts said there are four or five books here. So, you know, it's always getting that balance of some of the slightly more humorous stories combined with hopefully what we try and do is actually teach the reader something about the business of sport. And I think one of the things that's interesting about coronavirus is how sports fans have had to take much more of an interest in the business of sport. So I think focusing has helped synthesize the book in the way that we have.
What are the book's main conclusions?
Well, Simon can pick a few up, but I think we try and address a number of themes. One is where we start is actually how do you go about designing sports leagues. One of the extraordinary successes of the IPL has been how compelling it's been as a broadcast format, and an awful lot of that goes to the way the tournament was designed. I've always believed the essence of sport is unpredictable outcomes, and that's something that the design of the tournament has ensured happens with the IPL. We talk in the book a lot about the impact of private ownership and the importance of that in terms of bringing new capital and risk capital, because new tournaments require risk capital to experiment, to innovate. We talk a lot about regulators, and again, that to some people may not seem like the sexiest of topics, but we're learning through coronavirus just how important it is how countries are governed. I think sports fans are beginning to realise how important it is how sports are governed. And so we touch on that. We touch on how you maximise the value within a sports franchise and within a sports tournament. And then we try and chart a little bit of a set of predictions about how the future is going to unfold for the game.
Well, Simon, let's look at the future. You know, at the start of this discussion, what do you see as the future for cricket? In the UK, for example, Test cricket is hugely popular. The attendances for Test cricket are good, but they seem to be diminishing in other parts of the world. And does it feel sometimes like T20 versus Test cricket, or can the two exist comfortably together?
I think it depends in what country you are, actually. I think the great thing about the future and T20 is it's expanded the game, it's globalised the game, because resources are needed to run a test match team. You know, to have a successful test match team requires a good first class structure, it requires a lot of players, it requires quite a lot of grounds, and obviously a lot of money. Whereas to run a T20 team or a T20 league doesn't require quite as many resources. And there are so many countries now trying to play the T20 format who would never contemplate playing test cricket, because, you know, it's just impossible for a Nepal or an Ireland even to probably run a successful test match team. But there's no reason why they can't play T20. And I think my argument is that cricket is a very adaptable sport. It's one of the reasons why it survived so long from the 1700s onwards. It's always had different formats. You know, if you think back to the early days, it was played, there were 4-ball overs and 8-ball overs and double wickets and single wickets. And, you know, there's all sorts of different ways of playing the game. A very successful format of the game is last man stands in the world, which is 8-a-side, 16 overs, last man can bat on his own. So, you know, it is an incredibly adaptable type of sport. And Test cricket is the ultimate, it's the pinnacle, and all the great players want to play in it. And, you know, the countries that can still sustain Test cricket will continue to do so. But it doesn't mean that that other countries can't play other formats and be equally important. So I think the two or three formats can survive together. And, you know, it's up to each individual country to find what best suits them. But, you know, what I love about T20 and what I love about the IPL and, you know, all those sort of domestic tournaments that have evolved is that it gives cricket to cricketers and spectators at a time when they can play and watch, which is in the evening, during the week maybe, or even at weekends. I played in 20 over cricket when I was a kid, playing for Ealing Cricket Club, and it was a great form of the game, both for colts and for, you know, seniors. And, you know, the IPL and other T20 forms of the game have made it expand and have given more people the opportunity. And I just want to use this book and, you know, the connections with the IPL and the Royals to really prove that it's a great format of the game.
I do think we need to be a bit careful about how we describe Test cricket as the pinnacle of the game. I mean, it's my favourite format of the game as a spectator, and we tend to describe things as great because it's what players and commentators enjoy the most. And fundamentally, cricket is no different to any other sport in the sense that it's owned by the fans. It exists because of the fans and because of the grassroots participants. And actually, the reality is the behaviours and the needs of both fans and indeed of grassroots players who are more time scarce, who want more bite-sized experiences, are changing. So if Test cricket is going to survive, which I believe it can, to Simon's point, particularly in certain parts of the world, it is going to have to reconfigure.
What does that reconfiguring look like?
I think at a minimum, the whole debate about 4 days versus 5 days is pretty spurious, actually. I mean, if you look at England's last 75 test matches, less than a third have actually gone to the fifth day. And the vast majority of those involved, it was weather that got those games to the fifth day. And simply by creating a four-day format creates much more flex on the overall cricket calendar. I think we've got to look at the over rates within test matches. We've got to look at the time of day for them to continue to appeal to people who don't have the sort of middle class luxury of taking a day off and having a picnic during the week. So I think there's a lot of things that have to change about test cricket. And to Yoz's point, fundamentally, I think there are too many test playing nations. And we've got to recognise that it is a sport that can be played by a much smaller number of cricketing nations, and it needs to occupy a fixed but scarce, increasingly kind of scarce, part of the calendar.
So fewer test matches?
Fewer test matches, but bigger events. Ultimately, you know, the ability to stage these things, broadcast these things, fund these things and put them on requires media rights, and it requires media income. And we have to be careful that we don't create a world where the only reason test matches survive is because the economics are cross-subsidised from other formats of the game. We have to set our stall out to make test cricket a financially viable standalone product. And I believe we can. But if you look at the Olympics happens once every 4 years, and yet it's one of the most valuable sports rights in the world. If you look at Wimbledon, it's a 2-week tournament that has real scarcity value that people look forward to. They know when it's going to happen. They plan 9 months in advance. That's what England-Australia test series should be like. That's what England-South Africa test series should be like. That's what India-England test series should be like. So there's a real opportunity by actually reducing the amount of test cricket to actually increase the economic value of test cricket.
And actually that backs up with also with golf, you know, four major tournaments and tennis, you know, four majors in tennis as well. So, you know, that makes a lot of sense. I think there needs to be windows, and Manos will back this up, there needs to be windows for international cricket and windows for domestic tournaments. And also there needs to be a way of connecting all those domestic tournaments together with a global T20 tournament, a bit like the Champions League in football. And that integrates all these countries. It means that, you know, the champions of Nepal, for instance, their Premier League, which interestingly is called the EPL, the Everest Premier League, a champion of that could play against a Mumbai Indians or a Birmingham Bears or whoever, you know, and create that sort of great integration of the world game. And test cricket can still survive alongside that. And, you know, I just heard this week, actually, the MCC very keen still to stage the final of the World Test Championship in June next year. That is likely to still go ahead. And all the countries in the top eight of the test playing countries are all really engaged in trying to find ways to play, even in this unreal, you know, new normal environment. They're all wanting to play test cricket to try and make sure that the two teams get to that final at Lords, which will be a really big, you know, feature, a big prize to focus on for the next few months.
Let me pick up on something that Manoj said, though. He said that test cricket is propelled, if you like, by the current players who describe it as the pinnacle of the game and the media who describe it as the pinnacle of the game. But in 20 years' time, 25 years' time, as T20 cricket and competitions like the IPL become more and more prominent, those players won't see test cricket like that. And the people in the media, commentators, they won't see it like that either, because T20 cricket will have taken over. Is that how you see it? You talk about a new innings here. Is that how you see it, that actually there will be a seismic shift as time goes on in the next 20 or 30 years?
I mean, look, I think there's seismic shifts in every industry. There's seismic shifts in every aspect of how we live. We've seen more seismic shifts digitally in the last 6 months than we've probably seen in the preceding 6 years. So the notion that consumer tastes change, it's something that actually is just a reality of life. So I think the question is less for me, will Test cricket be there? And more, what do we need to do with Test cricket to give it a chance of being there? The economics of an industry and the economics of a sport rarely lie. I mean, the economics wins in the long term. And when you look at the cricket economy, a $2 billion economy, 33% now comes from the IPL, another 47% comes from matches played against India. Of that 47%, 80% of that is driven by ODIs that are played against India. So the point is that Test cricket is already a tiny part of the cricket economy. It's a decreasing part of the live cricket audiences. So we're at a point where the seismic shift has got to happen. Otherwise, it'll be a self-fulfilling prophecy.
But I would say that, you know, just to add to that, I'd say that, you know, T20 has really enhanced the Test match product by, you know, if you think back to that amazing innings of Ben Stokes last summer at Headingley, which I know, Simon, you commentated on. And, you know, that was that married, you know, old fashioned Test match technique of accumulation with incredible expansion and repertoire and audacity at the end of that innings. So it really married, you know, Test match skills and T20 skills. And, you know, added to that, I think the impact of the IPL, and we talk about this a lot in the book, is that it's increased the cricket's awareness to so many different communities. And I'm particularly thinking of women, actually. You know, now 40% of the viewers of the IPL are women. And, you know, we've kind of neglected, I think, for the last, you know, X number of years, cricket for women, to try and get them more involved. Obviously, the women's game is expanding and so on. But, you know, to make the game attractive to women as well is something that we've kind of ignored, I think. And the IPL has done that brilliantly by bringing in, you know, things like music and dance and celebrities and film stars, as well as brilliant, skillful players. And so it's made the whole product much more attractive to everybody in the community. And those people who started out watching maybe the IPL or T20 will gradually progress to Test cricket because they'll hear about these great players like Ben Stokes or Jofra Archer or MS Dhoni or Virat Kohli. You know, they'll want to watch those players in a Test match, having first sampled them in T20.
Who is this book aimed at? Who's your target audience? Who are you hoping reads it and takes on board some of the ideas contained in it?
It's a great question. I should let Yoza really comment. I mean, as someone who's never written a book before, that's a question quite a few people have asked. And I suspect, if I'm truthful, the motivation originally, for me at least, was very much to get the story of the IPL and the story of the Rajasthan Royals chronicled in a factual way. Because I think there are so many interesting stories and interesting learnings, not just for the business of cricket, but for the business of sport. So that probably means, first and foremost for me, it's about cricket fans. Second, it's probably, it'd be fantastic if cricket administrators and sports administrators looked at this and said, hang about, there's something we could learn from this, whether it's for cricket, whether it's for rugby, whether it's for soccer. You know, Simon's a fantastic writer, and so I think you know, he's added added a colour to it that makes it readable by people who simply want to learn about sport and learn about cricket.
Basically, of course, I was just desperate to write another book, really. But that's a facetious answer. I mean, really, I care about cricket so much. And, you know, hopefully that comes over in all the things that, you know, Simon, you and I do, like podcasts and so on. Just trying to get people more insight into how the game operates. I mean, we've tried to do in this book a little bit about the way that players have improved, the fact that the IPL is a sort of cricketing brainstorm, that, you know, it's a gathering of all these brilliant players and coaches, and people like Manoj have brought new ideas to the running of a team. And I suppose from spending, you know, most of my life around domestic cricket, county cricket, and obviously international cricket, I've seen, you know, a lot of mistakes made and a lot of kind of fairly poor practice gone on behind the scenes. It's frustrated me the way that the game has been run at times, at all levels, really. And so what we've tried to do with this book is give a few sort of pointers, ideas, suggestions for how to run the game more efficiently. And I think, you know, Manoj is a very sort of stimulating person to be around. He cares passionately about cricket, but he also sees that it's got to sustain itself. And so he's always thinking about those sort of ideas, how the game can be more sustainable. It's an expensive game to stage. You know, the players are now more expensive. Grounds, huge spaces, big areas of real estate have to be paid for. You know, it takes a long game. So, you know, you need a lot of kind of staff to look after it. But it's so rewarding in the end. So, you know, I suppose what we're trying to get over in this book is how to make the game survive from a financial point of view as well as from a playing point of view.
Let me just briefly interrupt this conversation to say that we're talking about my new book with Manoj Badali, A New Innings, the way that the reinvention of cricket through T20 has shaped the business of sport. And actually, we've created, as well as a website, anewinnings.com, which is where you can buy the book at a cut price. It is available on Amazon, but you can buy it at a reduced price at www.anewinnings.com. Also on that website, if you click on Join the Discussion, there is a huge platform there attempting to engage you all with the future of the game in lots of different facets. There's things about organising leagues, there's things about marketing the game, digital distribution, player management, biosecure environments, playing in a bio bubble, many other topics, how the analysis has really improved the playing standards of the game, and also a lot about innovation and how cricket is the most innovative sport in the world. And really, that's important for the game to survive and continue to flourish, is by continuing to be innovative. So go to www.anewinnings.com to have a look at the options to buy the book and also that free site.
When you bought the Rajasthan Royals franchise with a consortium back in 2008, did you do it with trepidation, Manoj? Did you do it with excitement? Was it just a sort of, you know, a shot in the dark? What did you expect to happen? What were you hoping would happen?
It's very easy to be sort of clever with hindsight. I mean, the truth is we'd actually been experimenting with innovations in the game through a business entity called Investors in Cricket for 2 or 3 years before the IPL. We acquired the commercial rights for Leicestershire County Cricket Club. We had a television show in India called Cricket Star, which was like a cheap sort of pop idol for cricketers. We even created actually and staged the first ever Champions League tournament between T20 teams from around the world, all of which were fantastically interesting but spectacularly unsuccessful. And that was primarily because one of the things you learn quickly in sport, and perhaps we were a bit slow getting there, is it's all about the value of the media rights. And so unless you can find a way to create valuable media rights, it's very hard to create a strong economic footing for either your franchise or for your league. And so what attracted me to the IPL in particular was the sharing of the media rights between the league and the teams. And in that first year, it was pretty much a 50-50 split. And so I remember explaining to a couple of my partners why I thought this was a good investment. And actually the line I used was, we're not buying a sports franchise, we're buying 7% of the IPL. And I think the IPL has all the ingredients to be successful. But clearly, we had no idea it was going to take off to the extent that it did.
What was your hunch at the time? I mean, did it feel like a gamble, or did it feel like, you know, a reasonably solid investment?
It definitely wasn't a hunch. It felt like a very solid investment, in the sense that there were, you know, we'd learnt enough about sport to know what we had to look for. And the first was obviously the size of the market. And, you know, India had just won the Cricket World Cup, the very first Cricket World Cup T20. So the country was gripped by T20, having actually never played T20 prior to that World Cup, or, you know, literally played one or two games. So we knew there was a market demand, and we knew it was a massive market. But the two things that really stood out were, one, the share of the media rights, but second, and this is something that is still a challenge for so many sports leagues and sports around the world, is there was a robust framework for maintaining the salary caps. So we had salary caps, and have always had salary caps in the IPL, but even as important as having a salary cap, as we've seen in rugby, by the way, is having a transparent procurement process. And so the auction meant that there was no way of cheating the salary cap. So we had a salary cap that could be policed, which meant that the cost structure was under control, and the revenues would ultimately be just driven by the number of Indian eyeballs. And we had a hunch that there'd be lots.
There's finance, and then there's glory. And in the first year, everyone said, oh, Rajasthan Royals, they've got a rubbish team. And you won the whole thing. I mean, how on earth did you manage it?
I think when people wrote us off that first year, they did so on the basis of a few misguided assumptions. One was that, you know, Shane Warne had been in retirement, and we made a big bet on him as not just the captain, but actually I'd got to know him before the tournament started. And in my mind, he clearly had a point to prove, because he'd never really had a chance to captain Australia in the way that he'd hoped. So we made a big bet on him as captain and coach, and that paid off incredibly. We also, and you know, Yoz will remember this, because I remember Yoz was sitting in our garden in Chiswick talking about the player selection. We tapped into cricket expertise to think about the structure of the team. But we also deployed a little bit of rudimentary, back then, what was relatively rudimentary technology and data, because that's the business I live and breathe and work in. And I've always thought that whether it's the media or the commentators or the coaches, the lack of science that was being applied to player selection back in 2008, was pretty basic. And I'd read a book by Michael Lewis on the famous, now famous, Billy Beane, and was inspired by that to apply some of that. And that paid off with players like Sahail Tanveer and Shane Watson, who were not household names, who made a huge impact in that tournament. I think the rest of it was down to, again, because we were cheap and because we were unknown, we didn't get distracted by a lot of the Bollywood off the field. We just kept the environment very, very focused on the cricket. That said, someone will quickly point out, we won it in the first year and we haven't won it since, so we're not that smart. We've got a lot of work to do.
I mean, I got involved, obviously, as Manoj says there, I got involved a little bit on the outset of the tournament. And in fact, I was involved with that cricket style programme as well before that we tried to do in India. And I mean, when I then kind of saw the development of the first IPL, going to the first game, you know, having been, you know, tangentially involved with the building of the Rajasthan Royals squad, then sort of wanting to see what actually happened, I went to the first game, and I was one of the only English journalists out there, and it was just compelling, you know. And it made me think back to the excitement I felt as a player in, say, a cup final. You know, I played in a few Lords finals, and the exhilaration you feel when you're doing something you love and you're in front of a massive crowd and there's a big trophy to win at the end. And, you know, the whole hype of that and the buzz around the ground and the sort of the thrill of it was so amazing. And this was replicated in the first match of the IPL, you know. And then you thought, well, surely it can't sustain it. And it has. It's sustained it for 12 years. The passion of India is so infectious about this game. So, you know, I wanted to try and capture a bit of that, really, in this book as well. And the Royals have had their ups and downs. It's been a fascinating sort of roller coaster ride. But in the end, it's about the game. And the game is still incredibly exciting to watch, and keeps evolving. And it's just been, I'm so envious because, you know, I'd love to have played in this form of the game. Because, you know, as professional cricketers especially, you want to play in front of a crowd. It's been so weird, hasn't it, this summer watching, you know, completely empty stadia at matches. And it does take the gloss off playing the match, which an IPL game just totally expands to the nth degree.
Is it enjoyable or glamorous running an IPL franchise, Manoj, or is it, you know, a constant headache? Is it a constant worry? Is it hard work? And is it frustrating? You know, what's the balance between those two?
Look, it's a bit of all of those things. And actually, I've always said it's actually quite nice running an Indian IPL franchise from Chiswick, because you can sort of switch it off, if you like. I think if you live in India, it's much more of a kind of constant demand, and it's much more visible. So actually, being here is sort of quite helpful. But look, it's a privilege. I mean, first and foremost, it's just, you know, I knew Simon when he played at Middlesex. I was playing at Stanmore at the time. You know, for most of us, we never attain the skills and the opportunities to play at that highest level. And so sports ownership is sort of, for me, it feels like the second best opportunity. But it's a privilege. But it, you know, what comes with the terrain is a high degree of visibility, a high degree of controversy. For a tournament like the IPL, which has grown so quickly and become so powerful within a country that's still evolving and maturing in terms of the way it runs itself and in terms of the way governance is applied there more broadly. So it's been incredible challenges. But I've also got a chance to see inside sport and see some of the really serious threats that pose the sport faces. We've been very focused on the COVID threat in the last 6 months, but actually probably the biggest threat for cricket is, you know, and for sport generally, is how it embraces the increasing power of the gambling influence within sport. Because back to that essence of sport being unpredictable outcomes, the minute the authenticity of the game is challenged, we have much bigger problems than whether or not we should play Test cricket or T20.
You do write about corruption in the book, things like spot fixing. It's something that's affected the Royals as well. I mean, how clean is the IPL? I mean, are you concerned that the perception of it in some quarters, even in India, which, you know, really bought into it, leads to doubts about its propriety?
Yeah, I mean, look, 2013 was probably the most existential crisis that the IPL faced when its veracity, its authenticity was challenged to the core. But what I would say is that the investments made in the anti-corruption units that are now part of cricket, the security teams that are now part of cricket, the hotel monitoring that is now part of cricket, are more extreme in the IPL than even in international cricket. So I don't believe that this is an IPL related threat. I believe this is an issue for the game. We need to continue to invest. The regulators, as in the governing bodies, need to embrace and tackle this topic much more fundamentally than we are doing. We've got to work with industry to deal with it, because, you know, like most industries, the participants generally outsmart the regulators if they're given a chance. So I'm not worried that the IPL is any less clean than any other part of cricket. But I am worried that spot fixing and the influence of gambling will grow, actually particularly in the secondary and tertiary leagues. Because when you have players being paid poorly in bit part leagues that no one's watching, it's much easier to be successful with a spot fix or to have the whole tournament sponsored by a gaming company. So, and that's particularly post-COVID, where the game's finances are under stress and sports finances are under stress. I think the whole of sport needs to look at how it embraces the gambling industry and ask itself whether it's doing it effectively or not. I mean, I worry even in soccer in this country at the fact that 27 out of the 44 Premiership and Championship football clubs are all sponsored by gaming companies. I mean, is that right? Is that what we want to be putting in front of our kids day in, day out? Is that what the social purpose of sport should really be about? Equally, it's an important part of the game, as Simon's written in several of his books, that we can't deny happens, but how we embrace it and how we deal with it is a really big question that we really just touch on in the book.
I think also there's an opportunity too with the, you know, gambling and gaming, especially the gaming area. You know, I like the way that, for instance, Dream 11 is now the new sponsor of the IPL. That's partly by default because the previous sponsor, Vivo, had to pull out for Chinese reasons. But the Dream 11 is an interesting concept because you basically pick 11 players from the match that you're watching before it starts, 11 of the 22. You select who's going to perform the best. And at the end of the game, you get points as a result of your selections and you go up a sort of ranking table and you can convert that into money. But essentially, it's allowed in India, which is where gambling is illegal, because it's regarded as a game of skill. And it is a game of skill. I mean, it's a game of luck as well, because, you know, it's lucky that when you pick David Warner, he happens to get a 50 on that particular day. But it does keep you interested. And I suppose, you know, if money isn't the only reason why you're participating in this game, if it's also because you fancy your chances of being able to predict what might happen, you know, you think that you might sort of read the game well and you know who's going to do well that particular day, and then you get recognition for that by going up the ranking table. So that's one sort of real opportunity for the game to kind of ally itself closer with that in a similar way to, I suppose, when you go to a horse race, if you're not really avid horse racing fan, by putting even a pound on a horse which you don't know much about, that actually focuses your mind a bit more closely on how that horse performs. I'm not saying that, you know, it's important to put money on the game, but it's just, it gets you another level of engagement.
Let me just move on to another aspect. I think one of the really interesting aspects of the book is that the English Premier League, the English Football Premier League, seems to defy some of Manoj's principles for a successful league, but it's clearly successful. I'm thinking, for example, it has relegation, which Manoj suggests that, you know, for a successful league is not a good thing, especially for franchise owners. It can be fatal for a team, you know, if you get relegated. We've seen that in the teams who've been relegated from the English Premier League have struggled. They've had huge financial problems. They've dropped down leagues. It doesn't have a player draft, which evens out the distribution of players. It doesn't have a salary cap. So the IPL has those things, and it has been very successful. Why is the English Premier League football being successful without some of the principles that have made the IPL very successful?
I think there's lots of parts to that. I mean, the first is we've got to be quite careful in terms of how we define success. So those principles that I allude to in the book are very much in terms of what makes a sports league and sports franchises investable. So if one of your objectives as a sports league is to bring in outside capital, outside investment, private investment, such that you expand the dollars available to innovate, grow, market, then the principles that we talk about in the book are very, very important. And so if you bring that to your question around soccer, I think the English Premier League is incredibly successful and it's incredibly remunerative and value creating for a relatively small subset of the English Premier League. So I think the players do extraordinarily well. But, you know, is success when Arsenal are laying off and making redundancies across their staff this week at the same time that they're paying 45 plus million pounds for a player? Is that sort of level of sort of inequality something that as a society we think is successful business or responsible business or inclusive business? There's a lot of talk in my world about responsible capitalism and inclusive capitalism, Well, that doesn't strike me as a successful, sustainable model where a small number of players get obscene amounts of money, whereas we have to furlough stewards, you know, in tough times. So I think that definition, and similarly, when you look at when you unpack the media rights and the quote success of the media rights of the English Premier League, 80% of the value in those rights is derived from less than 10% of the games in that league. And that's a big difference. In the IPL, every game attracts massive viewership because every game has an unpredictable outcome, and it's a tournament that has proven every team has a chance of winning. At the start of every English Premier League, the debate's not about who's going to win the league. The debate is which one of maybe six or seven teams are going to win the league. And back to that relegation, I think actually some relegation, you know, can be affected. But even now, we've had to adjust parachute payments and transition payments because the step change in economics required to get from the Championship to the Premier League is so dramatic to make it even competitive. So I think you've got to go back to that definition of success. You've got to go back to what actually are the economics of the English Premier League. And when you say it's successful, I say it's successful for the few.
So Manoj, if the Rajasthan Royals didn't win the IPL for another 25 years, would your franchise still be successful?
Yeah, no, I think it, you know, I think it comes back to the definition of success. I mean, I think for me, there are different components to that. One is your financial performance. One is your playing performance. One is the level of innovation that you bring to the game. One is your social purpose. One of the things I've been very proud of with the Royals is the enormous emphasis we've placed.
And it's successful for some of the reasons being that, you know, it's owned by, I think, 90 of the 96 clubs or something are privately owned by
platform that we have,
often very wealthy individuals who bankrolled the game. Without them, so, the game would be completely stuffed. And
all of those
already we're seeing some clubs
we may not have won
because our owners have lost interest,
but we are,
or
I think,
you know, gone bust or whatever. So,
as,
you know, while the top of the game is pretty sort of profitable, there's a lot of flat going on underneath the surface
analysis
of clubs that are really
player
struggling.
Value creation, i.e., the amount we pay for a player, and then what happens to that player's value over a period of time. You know, we come top, and I think we've made a huge impact to the lives of millions of people in India with our social work and our highlighting of social causes. And this year, you know, our as important a focus for us as winning the tournament or competing in the tournament is the spotlight that we're shining on women's periods, which are an undiscussable across huge parts of South Asia. Our principal sponsor is trying to change that. And using our digital content and using the incredible platform that is our players, if we can change attitudes around periods in India, we can make a massive difference through this tournament.
We could talk about cricket and the business of cricket for hours and hours. I just want to end this. A new innings then. If there's one aspect that you'd want to bring out from this book, one point, one lesson for the cricket community in general, your readership, what would it be?
I think for me, it would be that if you truly care about the game and you truly love the game as we do, then sport, whether it's cricket, whether it's soccer, whether it's rugby, whether it's hockey, whatever your sporting passion is, the regulation and governance of sport needs to be really well understood and much more heavily and more effectively invested in. Because if we get that governance wrong, it doesn't matter what debates we have. The choices that we make about the calendar, the choices that we make about the formats, the choices that we make about the balance of investment across men, women, young fans, if those decisions are wrong and continue to be suboptimal, then the future of the game is challenged. And I don't think enough sports fans understand that. And I don't think actually, by the way, enough people think about that question of how we are governed in everyday society. And having had this sort of reality show of coronavirus, where we have a kind of 4 p.m. press conference from our leaders, we've been drawn into the question of how we are governed. Who are these people who govern us? Are they the most effective people to govern us? In a way that is a conversation we've just never had in society. And if we can get sports fans having that conversation, if we can get commentators like you, Simon, really recognising the importance of that conversation and using platforms like Test Match Special to really stimulate that debate and inform that debate, that's for me the central message.
Yeah, my my message really is that cricket is such an innovative sport, you know, probably more so than any other sport, and we cover quite a lot of the innovations, and the IPL has brought in a few as well. So I suppose really that this book, A New Innings, is almost in part a celebration of innovation, because the IPL has inspired other similar tournaments. It's changed the way the game is played and operated and perceived. And I think that my message is, don't stifle innovation. Be fearless, be adventurous, as Lalit Modi was when he set this up in the first place. And, you know, look at England's success in the World Cup, which was based on fearlessness and, you know, kind of expression, self-belief. This book sort of encapsulates all that. So I would just say, you know, I hope cricket and sport doesn't stifle innovation, allows people to be imaginative, and the world's your oyster.
Okay, well, thanks to Simon for his input there, and hope you enjoyed that discussion. As I said before, join the debate by going to www.anewinnings.com, and there is an option there to join the discussion and say, tell us what you think, and enter some quizzes and polls as well about the future of the game. And talking of the future of the game, don't forget, Saturday morning, the Village Cup final, the Cricketer Village Cup final between Redbourne, who entered the competition for the first time this year, actually, amazingly, and have got to the final, and they're playing Colwall of Herefordshire in the final. It starts at 11 a.m. Saturday at Lord's, of course, although it's behind closed doors. Thank you very much to the MCC for enabling everybody to play that game. And it's going to be streamed live on both the Cricketer and also the MCC websites. So hope you enjoy that. Good luck to both teams, and we'll speak to you in the middle of the week. Thanks for listening.
Podcast Network.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com, and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.